Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 1999, and in the Creekside room this afternoon, we have the presenter Joel Oinas and his series Conversations in the Shade of the Tree of Life. And this session is Science, Faith, and the Darkening Future. This is tape 99-5.
And this is the start of my second week here. And last week I spent some time talking about the relationship and the history of science and theology. And I really owe it to the people that have to listen to the announcement about my sessions to say what I was talking about with the Tree of Life and the other tree and Scientia and Phides. And, you know, I remember this place as being really demanding and intellectual. And I thought I was preparing for a group that would really be hard on me. And so far, everybody's been very generous, so I didn't have to use Latin. But the main motivation was so that I could talk about science and about our faith or believing without using biblical words that are all loaded down with stuff. Because the church uses faith in four or five different ways, and science is used in four or five different ways. As far as the trees go, the two trees in the garden, at the beginning of the biblical narrative, there's the tree of life, and there's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So there are two trees. Those are my two trees. And science and theology meet under the tree of life these days. And all sorts of problems developed. They have disagreements when it comes to knowledge and how people think to know. So disagreements fostered under the tree of knowledge are now being sort of worked out under the tree of life. So if you don't like it, just don't listen. Announcement every time it comes up. But that's, you know, they told us, make sure your title has something to do with the theme. So I did. Let's start with prayer. Creator God, you have done great things for us, and we have not done enough for you. You saved us. Use us to save something else. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. The objective today is to take stock of creation and with an eye to the future. Last week was history, and we talked about astronomy and the cosmos. We talked about Darwin and how the church's sort of inert natural theology was challenged, and we all of a sudden were dealing with a dynamic universe, dynamic heavens, dynamic earth, dynamic nature, and it's really hard work for the church. It sort of demolished our medieval theological house, and so we're having to rebuild. We're right at the end of the millennium, and 1,000 years ago, the church was really worried about that and celebrated by building all those Gothic cathedrals. It took them hundreds of years, but after the year 1,000 passed, there was reason to think that the world would go on. And so we have sort of that opportunity. We have to decide on what kind of celebration we will have. And I think it will be sort of deciding that we will be responsible stewards in the next 1,000 years. Today we'll take a quick inventory of our situation at the beginning of the third millennium, and then we'll talk, and we have a day off Tuesday, and then Wednesday we'll talk about science, faith, and personal life, how it affects our day-to-day living in our house, in our car, in our family. And then we'll talk about what the future will look like and what kind of decision we make in science, faith, and public life, policies, education, and then the fourth session, that'll be Friday, we will take the sewer tour. We will take a look at the resource and waste streams at Holden Village, and we'll see if we can get somebody from operations to walk along and talk about that with us. But we'll look at where things come into the village, what they do with them, and where they go when we're done with them. So if you want to go on that tour, it's not for wimps. We'll have to walk a distance, but you know, it may take more than an hour, but it should show us some very interesting things about this village. The simple life is not simple. It's extremely hard. And then Saturday we'll do something fun. Talk about light, maybe. And we talked last week also about a vocation, and we never really got to where I had to state what I thought the vocation was. The primal vocation, Genesis 2, tend the garden. And when we screwed that up, we have all the other sort of repair work on the human animal still going on. And I have a feeling that what's going to happen, if we ever arrive and the new heaven and the new earth come, God's going to stick us in a garden again and say, tend the garden, and it'll start all over again. Somehow that's God's objective, is to have a harmonious world. And our position of, our theological position of dominion is necessary and is supposed to be beneficial for all. And we've had a tough time with that. So we're going to talk first of all today about sort of the givens that we have to work with. Science has been very good in supplying us with lots of givens. And we'll talk about trends. And I'm going to rely on you to tell me trends, because the trends, the dynamic world has so many trends. There's so many things that are increasing, so many things that are decreasing, that nobody can keep track of them all. And environmentalists have a full-time job, ecologists, and so they have to focus on little niches. Some people do atmospheric stuff, but they're all, we'll talk about the trends that we have in our day and age. Some trends are upward, some are downward. Then we'll talk about the complications, sort of the freight, the things that we used to think with that complicate the whole thing. And then we'll talk about implications. That's where I'm going to rely on you again. And then solutions. And I don't have anything to say about that at the moment. Okay, so the givens. Nobody is making energy anymore. The equation and the fact about energy is that there's a given amount in the universe. Right now it's concentrated in huge masses of combustion and fusion in the stars. And that energy radiates out. The only planet we know that's benefiting from that is our own. And all the energy comes from there. And when scientists are asked to talk about how this conservation of energy works out in the future, they say, well, eventually it all runs down. And everything separates, and we're starting to get this uniform soup that's cooling off, and things are moving just a little bit. The energy is all there, but it is sort of distributed evenly, and we have sort of a warm puddle of a universe. Okay, does anybody contest that? I mean, I don't know exactly how to defend that, except that you won't find a single physicist that they talk, maybe if we spread out enough, it'll start all over again, it'll all snap back together, big bang again, and it'll run down again. But somehow the energy never is created or destroyed. But what in our case, what happens is it goes from useful forms into useless forms. And the useless forms is that we mostly talk about is heat, excess heat. We open the windows to get rid of it when we're cooking. Eventually, all the electrical appliances that we use, our automobiles, the heat, the energy radiates as heat, and it's lost to us. It moves molecules somewhere else, but it doesn't help us at all. The thing that was really amazing about our particular situation is that the sun supplies all the energy we need. And if you want to memorize this is good. Solar power, and we'll just put power equals 0.134 watts per square centimeter. That's all we get. That's been going on as long as the sun has been in its present state. That means a meter by a meter is about 800 watts of sunlight. Now that's for the circumference of the Earth. That's what the sun delivers to us in electromagnetic energy. Any questions about that?
Duh.
Well, you know what a 60-watt light bulb is, okay? You would know what a 100-watt light bulb is. The sun is capable of delivering for every square meter about 800 watts. Watts is the amount of energy per unit time.
So what's the time?
A watt, it's per second. This is for every second. Per second. Watt is in joules per second. Okay, but that's all there is. That's all there is. Now there are some energy around from the origin of our planet. For instance, the moon does pull the tides, and I think there are ingenious people that have figured out ways to make the tide power generators of some sort. But that's very little. There's very little opportunity to exploit that. And then there's thermal energy from the earth, but that was, you know, that was from a long time ago too, from the creation. But right now, coming into our planet, it all comes from the sun. Now we can think of other kinds of energy. For instance,
fossil fuels, which is solar energy. But
did it come from the sun? Well, somebody say something about that. How is oil and coal from the sun?
Organic.
It used to be a plant, right? Plants depend upon the sun. Okay, how about?
Free radical.
What is it?
Well, radio.
Oh, that's different. Those are unstable compounds that when they fall apart, they release energy. That's not exactly from the sun. That's right. So that's what nuclear energy is. But we've sort of, as a society, said that's so dangerous, the likelihood of us using it, unless we get really desperate, are likely. How about Holden Village's electrical power comes from?
Hydro.
Now, from the sun?
Yes. Call it the water to evaporate.
The water cycle. Yeah, the water runs out of there and the snow doesn't form, it doesn't fall up there and then melt. You don't have hydropower. Wind power?
How about cooling of the planet?
Okay. Wind only flows because of the variety of solar radiation on the surface. How about, what was the old standard around here? We talked about fuel oil, but how about wood? From the sun. And I'm just going to write, this is a little chemistry. You're going to get a little chemistry and a little math. Right? Okay? This is the formula that makes energy. Let me do this again. 6 water molecules. Okay? H2O. Two hydrogens, one oxygen. You all know enough chemistry. Okay. Plus 6 carbon dioxide. Plus sunlight equals 6 oxygen plus 1 molecule of glucose plus. Yeah. And the energy from here is stored in the bonds here. This is what chlorophyll does. This is the green plant cycle. Most of it happens in the ocean. Over 50% of it is done in the ocean. But every tree out here, every green plant you see, has this going in it. And what happens is, and what has been happening for the, 2-3 billion years our planet has been around, is that, that this side of the equation has been building up. There's good evidence in the rocks that we look at. Maybe Dan could say something, that our planet began with an atmosphere full of carbon dioxide and water, and somehow through the miraculous appearance and evolution of chlorophyll plants, we began to produce oxygen and glucose out of that. Now what happens is this becomes the tool and the energy for building all the organic life that we have. Our bodies have hundreds of chemical reactions that begin with varieties of this. This, the plant uses itself to build woody parts and vegetable parts, things that we eat, things that animals eat, and then the animals process it. We eat the animals, we eat the plants. And what happens is this gives rise to a huge amount of biomass. That's kind of a gross word, but that includes our fossil fuels, like coal, which is layer and layer of vegetation smashed down and put under great pressure until there's nothing left but carbon and some hydrogen. And the other fossil fuels are there too. Our huge reservoir of green plants and vegetative material, the forests, this huge biomass. There is another reaction to complete this cycle, and that is it's chemists are, they like these beautiful formulas. And true enough, it releases energy. This is what is going on in every reaction after this one. That the combination of water, food, sugar, and this is supposed to be oxygen, excuse me. This is just like my physics class. Only my students will correct me faster than you. With breathing oxygen, this is called the respiration cycle. Okay, the aerobic, meaning with oxygen, respiration cycle. Oxygen plus glucose will yield water, carbon dioxide, and energy. And we do this. This is what all animals do. And make we breathe, we eat, we make water, and we breathe out most of our water through our respiration through our lungs, and we breathe out carbon dioxide. Now, the alarming thing in recent times, there's a lot of evidence that this built and built and built over millions of years, is that human beings have begun the decline of this biomass. The trend that our use of vegetation, the forests, what we've cut down, our use of fossil fuels, the big reserves in the ground, our increase in population and more creatures like us doing this. And so what has happened is we begin to see a rise, just an incremental, small rise in the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. Small, and scientists are always cautious. They don't know exactly what's causing it, but they suspect that it's our overworking of this side of the formula. And so all this reserve is subject to this side of the equation and producing, just using the biomass up, not in balance, faster. And that's just the basic given. That goes on, that's life as we know it, as far as the chemist goes, is like that, with a lot of kind of messy stuff in between. Okay, any questions on that? Anybody alarmed, or is this just...
There's a man in Port Angeles that is the second stanza of the sign saying about our use of automobiles in terms of increasing CO2, and he regularly is out with his sign. Mm-hmm.
The one for a car isn't very different, except the C has an 8, that's what octane is, okay? But it'd be oxygen, octane will produce water, carbon dioxide. Our cars, any internal combustion does this as well as us. We do more of it. You know, we walk 10 miles. We do a fair amount of it. But if you drive, take your 2-ton piece of machinery and drive it that far, you speed it along. Okay, so that's a given. That the tendency now is that we're doing this more than this, and to keep that in balance is fundamental for life as we know. Okay, now we're going to do a little math. I have a calculator here. I need somebody to run it. One of the most important things in understanding the dynamic natural world is a piece of math called the exponential growth. And it's kind of intimidating sounding, but it isn't really. There are actually buttons on the calculator that you can simulate this stuff. As a way to get into it, we'll talk about the legend about the person who invented chess. The king that it was invented for was so pleased with it that they said, you can have whatever you want. And the inventor of chess said, well, I have a simple request. I'd like you to take one grain, 64 squares on the chessboard. I'd like you to take one grain of wheat, put it on the first one, mm-hmm. and put 2 on the next. Double it, put 4 on the next, and do that through the whole chessboard. So who wants to try this on the calculator? I'll get it started, okay? We'll take 1 times 2, and then every calculator has this function, the equal sign. We get, we get a 2. Now, the cool thing about these calculators is if you just keep pressing the equal sign, it'll continue the operation with the multiplier of the last number you put in. So that's square number 1. That was 1. Square number 2 is here. 2. I want 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, fire week?
5242888.
We're up in almost 2,000,000, 250,000 grains. So 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64. 9 times 10 to the 18th. 9 with 18 years after. It's more wheat than it's ever been grown in the year.
Cumulatively or annually?
Well, I'm not sure. It's just a lot. It was more than the king could afford. We learned an important lesson. Now this applies to all sorts of natural occurrences. And because it's a little bit arcane, and you have to do this with the calculator, most people don't realize the seriousness of this, because you do have to do this math. But take, for instance, we'll take a very tiny microscopic organism, divides in two at a regular interval, okay? And we'll put it in, say, like a gallon jar, okay? And we're going to assume that it doesn't have anything that interferes with its doubling. And we're going to say it doubles every minute. And after an hour, this microorganism fills the glass jar. This is important because it has to do with population growth. Anything that doubles has to be subject to this math. But let's think about that. Okay, we have this tiny organism, can't be seen. It's in a gallon glass jar. It's going to reproduce, double at regular intervals, say every minute, and then it's going to be full. Okay, everybody got that? It's going to double every minute and be full. So after 1 hour, it'll be full. So say it's from 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock noon. At noon, it's full. How full is it at 11:59? How full is it at 11:58? How full is it at 11:57? Suppose you were one of those bugs, and you were living in a container that was only an eighth full. And you were the administrator, or this, you know, sort of the population, the minister of population there. This jar is 1/8 full. What would you tell your people?
Don't worry.
There's plenty of room, right? This is 4 minutes to noon. And then a minute later, it doubles its quarter, an eighth. You can go back and find it. 30 minutes before, you still couldn't see in the bottom of the jar the collection of organisms. But the growth is doubling, and when doubling occurs, the increase is astounding. For instance, if it's only half full at 11:59, it's full at 12. What's going to happen at 12:01?
Two jars.
12:02. Do we have a population problem now?
That assumes there's food to feed the organism.
Yeah. Right. We're assuming that a huge disaster doesn't happen to interfere with the math. And that's really what
the
has
organism to be. Isn't capable of regulating its self-limit.
Yeah. And then, after 64 doublings, we fill the universe. Okay. That goes on when you talk about doubling, increase in the amount of topsoil that washes in. It has to do with doubling of the loss, you know, decreases. And we could go backwards and half that number, say, and it works forward and increases. And you can understand why people that know math and deal with exponents will say, we are in trouble, even though you look around and say, what trouble? And although population trends can never just go skyrocket, Malthus said that they run out of food and then they taper off or plummet. But that's talking about a disaster of proportions we're only beginning to see. And it has happened in corners of the world where food production has not kept up with population, and there have been disasters. And although we're distant from it, if we were there, we would see just the misery of population out of control. So that's the math, that's the given from the map. And we have finite stuff. We have a planet that isn't getting any bigger. And it's a wonderful, it's wonderfully symmetrical with the story in Genesis. You know, the dome, the firmament, it was limited. And our planet is, there's only so many square feet. And right now, even though we're losing arable land at a tremendous rate, there's about 2.25 acres of farmable land for every person in the world. Now, if the population doubles, that means we'll have 1 1/8. And it's very difficult to keep track of all that, but one of the ways you do is see what productivity in the farm and farming looks like, and productivity is beginning to taper off. That's another. So we have a lot of finite stuff, finite surface area, finite arable land. The world is round, it's not flat, and goes on forever. So those are the givens, okay? And there are some things that are in a way renewable. For instance, topsoil, which is right now on the decrease. But topsoil takes between 200 and 1,000 years to produce an inch. Even out, especially out in this forest, it takes a long time to produce actual soil for things to grow in. And Iowa farms lose, they can lose tons off of every acre every season. And I know that my area in Wisconsin is very carefully farmed with contours and cover crops, but the soil conservation office says we've already lost 2/3 of our topsoil. We use it up faster than we can reproduce it. So it's a yes.
And where does this topsoil go to?
The topsoil
delta.
Yeah, it usually goes in our area. In the Midwest, it washes down the rivers, becomes unstructured outwash in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, and you just have to go to New Orleans and look at the delta, look what's happened in the last 100 years on there.
Yeah, that's all of, that's Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota and all the states in between down there.
Leo Houston used to say we lost 7 bushels of topsoil for every bushel of corn grown.
Yeah. In this country. Yeah, that's fair. It's fair to say, although the practices now are not to expose the topsoil, but the trade-off has been that they've had to use pesticides to control weeds, which are usually killed in moldboard plowing. So it's a difficult thing. Farmers know that their livelihood as well as their vocation feeding the world depends on the health of their land, and it's been a difficult time for farmers to. Assembling all that. So let's, yeah, you have something else?
And then also, I was thinking too, the growth of the suburbs has taken so much of the area.
Okay, yeah, now we're talking about trends, and that's what I was going to talk about, given the fundamental energy, the fact that we have a finite amount of land and topsoil and arable land, and now we're talking about trends. I talked about the math of the upward population, and you're talking about how urbanization is happening. Suburb.
We don't think, well, we shouldn't build it here because that's topsoil that we need. Mm-hmm. We should build it someplace where we can't farm. We just build wherever it's convenient.
Right, or close.
Or close.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We do have a reservoir that is not being used for food, and that's tobacco farming.
That we grow tobacco instead of food.
Yes.
Yes. That's tobacco pays the bills in my state. I had a colleague who. His first day on the call, he went to visit the first farmer in his congregation. The farmer took him out, put his arm on his shoulder and says, "See that? That's tobacco. That built the church." He was looking for another call right away. It was someplace. That my area in Wisconsin, there's still government subsidies to grow tobacco, wrapper tobacco. Okay, trends. We talked about upward population. Our energy use is still going up, and all you have to do is think about all the people in Asia who want development, want a higher standard of living, and you know energy is going to continue to grow up as people aspire to live like we do. Consumption goes up. Urbanization, which means fewer percentage of people are on the land, more and more people pack into the city. It's especially a problem in developing countries where the development money goes to the cities and employment opportunities look better there. So we have more and more people crowding into the cities. Airborne pollutants, solid waste, they're all on the increase. And the decrease, we lose 7% of our topsoil each decade. And in 100 years, that means half of it disappears. Our groundwater is slowly sinking. People in Colorado and people that use deep well irrigation know about that, and usually it affects the people that don't have the money to dig wells first, so it doesn't get a lot of press. But as the aquifer goes down, and aquifers take a long time to fill up, so it's actually sort of a non-renewable resource, water becomes more and more of a problem. So arable land is going down, fossil fuels, that the estimate I read in the book I have is a 1985 book. It says 42 years of fossil fuel reserves.
Of known pockets.
Known pockets. Whether they're unknown ones, nobody, you know, maybe. Maybe there are.
Talking about that aquifer, South Dakota has a problem with that because we're being flooded. And the farms that used to be farms are all lakes now.
Do you know how that relates to the aquifer? Or?
Well, not really, because that water up in northeastern South Dakota, that's good gold, comes down the river. The aquifer comes into the aquifer from way out in the Black Hills, you know, the Rocky Mountains.
But the aquifer has to be full of water in order for it all to stay on top like it does, don't it? I know you, not necessarily, but areas that are.
Okay. There could be reasons that the water stays on the surface. You know, it could be a change in weather patterns.
People say that as
carbon dioxide, certain research shows that as carbon dioxide goes up in our weather, and our temperature, average temperature gets warmer, just even incrementally warmer, then weather becomes more severe. Mm-hmm. And the storms that generate in the tropics become more violent. And scientists are very cautious. They don't say we see a trend yet, but you know the storms that we've had.
And the
rainforests. Yeah, and the rain in South, it was an unheard of rain in North Dakota.
This has been happening to South Dakota for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
That the farmland has become a swamp.
Yeah.
Yeah, but for, you know, the whole decade of the 30s, dirt blew over the bottom of those lakes that are West Creighton's hometown, where now they're flooding over the highway. So it's just a weather cycle.
Well, a long-term weather cycle, maybe. Whether there's a trend emerging, you just got to wait and see. But all the time, the clock is ticking here. So we've talked about Givens trends upward and downward. The complications, this is where I think it gets interesting, is the first law of ecology is to fix things. You cannot do just one thing. That's the first law of ecology. You cannot do just one thing. For instance, 1955, malaria was a problem in Brunei. It was North Borneo, I think, or East Borneo. Brunei is one of the richest and most, I think, one of the per capita has the highest energy use. It's ahead of the United States. There's four others that are ahead of the United States in per capita energy use. But back in 55, it was fairly primitive, and they had a problem with malaria. Well, the way to fix malaria was to do one thing, spray dieldrin on the mosquitoes. And they did, and killed the mosquitoes. But they also killed the flies and the cockroaches in the houses that were thatched with leaves, which the residents didn't mind. But what happened shortly after that was the little lizards that lived in their houses were feasting on the dead cockroaches and flies, and they all died. And as they became sick and died, the cats who preyed on the lizards were eating sick and contaminated lizards, and the cats all died. And then the mice and the rats just proliferated out of control. They had this population trend. With no natural enemies, their population took an exponential curve, and they were everywhere, and they brought the Sylvatic plague back to Brunei. This is all because they sprayed for malaria. And they had to bring in hundreds and thousands of healthy cats to try to deal with the mice. And importing cats to Brunei. And they also found, as time went on, that the wasps who preyed on caterpillars had died, and certain kinds of caterpillars which were resistant to the insecticide dieldrin, and they munched away on the roofs of all the Brunei residents, and the roofs all fell in because there weren't wasps to kill the caterpillars. And it was a disaster. This is just to illustrate that the first rule of ecology, that you cannot do just one thing. You decide to do something in the natural world, there are going to be all sorts of consequences. And science has become very circumspect about offering those kinds of solutions now. I think it started with environmental impact statements. You had to say, what would happen if you did this? And they're becoming more and more conservative about it. So that's the one thing, first law of ecology. That's a complication. You cannot do just one thing. So if we imagine that we're going to fix or change something and maybe have a simple solution, there are going to be lots of people cautioning and saying, we need to look and see what the consequences will be. Okay. The second one is that science, as I said, was getting more complex and uncertain about things. They used to be pretty confident that science could fix things. Now, you remember those days where they would all know everything and they could, you know, that lumber companies could cut down all the trees and plantations of trees. And we did that in Central America, just bulldozed the forest and planted bananas. And we've done it in Texas with cotton. And we've done it in the Midwest with corn. And we've always, for a long time, could apply simple solutions to our needs. But we found that nature has a way of having the last word, and that certain there's complications that develop. Soil loses its fertility if it doesn't have a diverse community. You use pesticides to control all the pests. You kill the beneficial bugs and plants, and the soil becomes sterile. Business is not, but science is more reluctant to say that this will fix that. That they have a fix for something. The third complication is the problem, the tragedy of the commons. And it was Garrett Hardin, the environmentalist, who enunciated this, saying that if it's not yours, you don't own it, you aren't going to care about it as much. And if it's something we all hold in common, like the air, like the dump, like the Holden sewer, you know, if it's something we all have in common, somebody else is going to deal with it. And you can think of other examples. The air that we breathe, the ocean. Holden, in a way, suffers from that because nobody stays forever. There isn't an owner that's here. And although people are very conscientious here, there's still ways that things that you would take care of at home to your house don't get done, right? You're speaking as a housekeeper. Yeah. And Holden is exemplary in the responsibility that the guests and the short-term staff and the long-term staff show here, but it is not the same when it isn't yours and you feel final and ultimate responsibility for it. And there's so many things in our society that are just the commons. That was first applied to the pasture land of England, where anybody could go out and pasture their sheep and goats. And what happened? It just got ate up. And it was desertified, and the pasture land was destroyed. And then there was the enclosure was, and then the aristocrats took it over. And that's how they solved the problem, by disenfranchising everyone from the commons. It became ownership was one way to solve it. We have the same problem, like I said, with the ocean, with our air. So it's the tragedy of the commons. Part of that is not in my backyard. NIMBY stands for not in my backyard. So very, very dangerous technologies, or ones that are questionable, or ones that are unpleasant for people who can afford to raise a stink. They say, we know we need to dump, we know we need a toxic waste, but not in my backyard. Put it somewhere else in a way. And we found that there's racism connected with the NIMBY response. That all has to do with the tragedy of the commons. And also the OSOM, out of sight, out of mind. And Holden's sewer system is a real good example. Are you going to be here Thursday? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you'll get to experience it firsthand. Holden limped by for years with a collection, a little building down just beyond Narnia that collected the sewer water. You know, whatever you flushed down went and ended up in that little concrete building. And it never worked very well. And as Holden grew and as more things, as the use was more intensive, it just got overburdened. And somewhere along the line, they finally decided to tear it down, build a new one. And we'll look at this on Friday, but right out, just outside of Narnia, there's a big sort of unnatural gravelly area. That's where the tanks are. Like, you can see the little vents there, and you can see the three or four round access holes there. That's where the waste is. That's where everything we ate 3 days ago is sitting. Now, when that was put in, everyone was so happy and so overjoyed, but it was out of sight, out of mind, and it never got pumped. Now, it wasn't negligence, it's just, once it's flushed, in all our lives, nobody ever worries about it. I have a septic tank I have to pump every two years, but it filled up. It filled up all three of the chambers. It filled up with human waste, all the pipes. And I think it even pumped undigested waste clear down and filled up all the lines in the drain field that's clear at the other end of the village. And so it's just packed with waste. All because it was out of sight, out of mind. And what we're going to do Thursday is they're going to clean it all out. They're going to take, is it 30,000 gallons of undigested, partly bacterial, that's human waste, put it in a truck, haul it to a distant location, and pump it out. And while they're doing that, everybody's going to use porta potties. Somebody's going to crawl down in those holes and patch it up, and every single pipe to every house is going to have some sort of photo-optic line put down to see if it's leaking, to see if it's broken, to see if it's blocked, to see if there's water infiltration. Sewer systems are notorious for out of sight, out of mind. And Holden, as conscientious as it is, just forgot to do that. Now, somebody else might have another story on that. I'm not blaming anyone here, but I know how easily it happens.
Is there another story? Okay.
There's six other stories.
Is it even close to the truth?
Parts of it are right.
Okay. Jake can fill you in on the real.
I heard that the management by crisis theory of Holden, that this is sort of the crisis that needs to be managed.
Yeah, well, and this is a great microcosm for the problems that face us all, because Holden is very good about keeping track of its waste, and you've never worked so hard to recycle as you do here. But on the tour on Friday, we'll see that even though it's all that effort goes into it, we still are a very messy species.
Isn't there a septic tank ahead of this drain field?
Yeah, there's a septic tank, a settling tank, and I think there are three chambers, and the digestion is supposed to take place.
It just didn't work.
Well, it got flooded. I think it got filled up, and then it kind of flooded, and the tanks weren't differentiated anymore. And then the undigested fluid, rather than being pumped,
Okay.
In Arizona, in some places, they separate the gray water from the stool water. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that would make any difference, maybe in getting filled them up too fast or something.
Probably would.
The gray water then.
It'd just be one more thing for you to do, to separate your gray water from your.
Probably do that with us.
The whole. They use the gray water to water their lawns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't you wonder how cities like New York work?
I'd be scared to
hear the ocean. That's how
it works.
It's huge. It's pumping out 50 miles down the ocean.
I mean, you go to Guatemala, Guatemala City, the sewage is about ready to, I don't know what's going to happen to it. You never put paper down the toilet in Central America or Mexico.
Or in Africa.
Well, I think it's this out of sight, out of mind, the tragedy of the commons is one of the complications in solving our environmental problems. Another one, and it's unique to our particular situation, is that we have electoral politics that always take the short view.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You won't elect, nobody can ever win an election by saying, well, I'm going to make sure we all have something to eat in 50 years. I'm going to make sure that the price of gas never exceeds $10 a gallon.
But, Joel, it isn't just our elections. It's our business, too.
Okay. That's another complication, is our economy tends to run on a fiscal year.
Well, because every business, yes, every business has to show a good quarter to keep its stock prices up. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the board is out of there.
Okay, so there's a lot of motivation to have a short-term gain and ignore long-term problems. It's not profitable for businesses to invest in long-term solutions.
I used to say that. I still think it's true for most of us, but on the other hand, Microsoft, I think 25% at least of its operating budget goes into research and development. So they're looking to the future to try that. Now, it doesn't mean that what they're trying to build is going to be sustainable for the planet, but they're interested in being here down the road. So there are some companies that invest a great deal of money, but they tend to be in very dynamic industries where if you don't invest that kind of money, you won't be here.
Okay.
But I think you're right.
Microsoft's research and development, it's all going into smaller and smaller chips. They're not spending and investing in all pure septic tanks.
Well, it's easier to compost smaller chips.
there are other companies that do spend a large amount of money on research and development.
Mm-hmm. Monsanto may be spending 20% on research and development, but their products,
right?
That brings up the interaction between short-sighted government and short-sighted enterprise. That if there was some sort of a check or some sort of reward for doing long-term thinking that would protect and benefit the planet or the citizens, then maybe they would do that. But there's nothing.
Speaking of composting chips, that's how China got a lot of the information that they did is from the computers that were discarded.
Thrown away? Yeah.
What I've heard is the solution to the tragedy of the commons is that the reason people use those resources is that there's a net benefit to them. You know, I get to raise my sheep, whatever. But the mm-hmm. solution to it is when you use a resource, you incur the full cost of the resource you used. Mm-hmm. Now, difficult to legislate, mandate,
yeah.
And
see that doesn't work voluntarily in
right.
the commons.
Right.
So you're talking about policy. That,
I'm talking about policy. Yes. Yeah. You pollute the air. That's fine, but you have to suffer the full cost
right.
of removing your pollution. And yeah. when you invoke systems like that, people tend to become real, real careful because mm-hmm. the cost of what people wind up doing is really expensive.
When you cut down a tree and say, well, you know, okay, that was going to yield so much timber feet or board feet, but that's just its economic
right,
value. Its
right.
ecological right, value right. is huge.
The full
its processing.
Yeah. The full cost, and it's difficult to determine
exactly.
what that cost is.
Yeah.
Well, if there were, yeah, and that's because. Well, it's easier to externalize and then charge the customer for it. If there was some way that it was in the interest of business to compute the full cost, they could do it.
Yeah, I mean, if the house of the mining company had to take into account the full cost of its tailings disposal, oh. you wouldn't have the tailings up there. Well, the mine might not have been there.
Yeah, you wouldn't have cut
it. So, I mean, it is very
important. This is just an aside. I guess recently, or when the house hounds sold the mine, they somewhere along in a different transaction they sold the liability to these tailings. I'm not sure what that means, except that they can pass on the responsibility for making sure these are safe to some other company. Luckily, it didn't go to Holden, but it went to a company now that bought the liability along with other assets and figured that the cost of the liability was far below the value of the other assets. So they agreed to be responsible for the tailings. And now the Forest Service is suing this company, and that has to do with the sewer system. I spent a night with Christopher talking about this. And he said that the ideal solution is to take two problems and make one solution. Take the human effluent after it's treated, pump it up onto the tailings, create soil, reconditioned tailings. But the problem is that there's a lawsuit between the Forest Service and this company that owns the liability. And if Holden steps in and sort of messes with that up there, mm-hmm. then they increase their liability. And this company, which is going to have to pay money to the townies can sue Holden Village and say, you pumped poop up on our thing. We can't do what we wanted to do. So Christopher says we have to rehabilitate the sewage system here so it'll last until they settle their lawsuit. And as soon as they do that, that company will say, that's the great solution. It'll be cheap. You pump your poop up there, we'll, you know, the stuff will grow and we'll get off easy. But until the lawsuit's done.
What did this company think they were doing economically?
It was in a package. They bought a package. You know, this mine holding, all this land. But it was like playing hearts and trying to dump the queen of spades.
It might have been the same company that took a lot of valuable stuff from the mine and sold it, but left stuff that wasn't financially feasible to haul out, barge down, and sell as scrap. I mean, they decimated the mine itself, the company that then walked away.
And they were responsible for the tailings, too.
Well, I don't know.
But they maybe bought the liability and salvage rights, took what they could, declared bankruptcy, or sold it to somebody. And another company thought they could take care of this and still make money on the other parts of the package.
Part of that was the war and copper, and the government did anything to get the copper out of here during some of those years. And they gave them anything they wanted.
Okay, so we've been talking about complications, and we've got about 10 minutes left. So we talked about the complexity and uncertainty of science, the first law of ecology, you can't do just one thing. The tragedy of the commons, electoral politics, short-sighted enterprise, you know, the quarter, profits for the quarter. The other is that it's really hard to predict the future. Nobody knows anything about the future. There are a lot of people. A lot of people are claiming the future as their own turf, and business does it best. The marketeers do it best. They either create this beautiful image of the future you're moving to and the stuff you need to get there, or they scare you to death. So you got to get your stuff before it's gone, so that you can have a good life. Now all of it talks about the future, and nobody can say anything very certain about the future. Scientists are very circumspect about predicting. And that's one of our problems too, is because no one will be able to tell us. And so if we don't want to believe that there's a crisis, we really can find somebody that will speak our language. Okay. And the final one is that, this is not a complication for anybody but Christians who take God's promises seriously, that when you go to bed at night in order to sleep, sometimes you have to say to yourself, well, God knows. It's in God's hands. The trouble with that is that you will not find a promise of a happy ending without convulsions in between. I don't know, I won't say any more about that, but you can't find an easy path to the blessed future. All the Bible conversations about it are scary. And I don't know what they mean. You know, other people try to be more specific in predicting it. But it seems to me you can make an easy case saying, we will bring it on ourselves. And that it's perfectly possible the convulsions that we will endure will be of our own making. And God may have to salvage and may have a few words with us about our care of the earth. Well, that's complications. Implications. I just have two, but I'd like to hear from you, and then we can talk about solutions. Well, we'll talk more this week. The next session will be on Wednesday, and we'll talk about science, faith, and personal life. Live simply so that others may simply live, but not about policies, not about community, not about national efforts, but about what it means for you. And then the next day we'll talk about public life. But two implications that I have, sooner or later, there will not be enough. Number two, the future will always be uncertain and contested. So we will never have a definitive agreement until the wolves are at the door that, oops, we better do it now. I hope
hope we don't have to wait for that time, but it seems like that as long as the future is contested and nobody knows anything about it, we are in trouble. Now, I want to hear from you on implications and sort of solutions.
This isn't either, but I'm just wondering what people in your field would say about how much damage does, like, a war that we're having with Yugoslavia do in terms of what do bombs do to the total environment? Just, do we know what one bomb will do to speed this kind of thing up, or...
Yeah, I guess I'm, first of all, I have to give a disclaimer. I'm not a scientist. I'm a high school physics teacher. I would guess a bomb in your neighborhood would be bad. destructive, yeah, throw all sorts of stuff, kill, and leave harmful things behind. What was a shocking, unexpected thing was how devastated the Soviet Union was. Mm-hmm. 1985, the most polluted nation on earth was Poland. Mm-hmm. Every place where you couldn't see the sky, you couldn't tell what color the grass or the soil was. This was all in pursuit of industrial dominance. And as in a totalitarian society, there was when it was out of sight, out of mind, or it was just not attended to. There was no voice saying, "What about the trees? What about the earth?" So that would be my response about it. It's not exactly war, but it turned out that sort of...
This Poland, that country, Hungary, and old people, burned all this high sulfur coal. And of course, the sulfur made sulfuric acid rain. And they have destroyed all of the trend of the winds is northwest. And they have... Acid rain has acidified all the lakes in that whole area, clear through Scandinavia. Yeah. There isn't any fish in any lakes in Norway.
See, and this is we've had a debate all along about the need to industrialize and to compete during my lifetime. But we've always had these voices saying, which you cannot damage it if it damages the earth. And my dad was, in his early days, was kind of an unrepentant anti-environmentalist, saying all you do is want to tie the hands of industry. There's no problem out there. Luckily, we did, because we're looking, when we look at the Soviet Union, we're looking at what our future might be like if we're just, if we're unreflective about what industrial development can do. And I think other developing countries have the same prospect in front of them.
You sound like a first world person, though, when you say there will come a time when it isn't enough. Two-thirds of the world doesn't have enough now.
Well, and you're right. That's one of my short-sightedness, out of sight, out of mind. But you're right. The effect is already occurring, and we are insulated from it.
What about open doors?
Open doors for?
When Europe and Asia became crowded, America came along. They came to America. Is it a possibility with computers and all that they do nowadays, which are practically considered, probably could have been considered a miracle by somebody maybe 100 years ago, suppose that we are able to go over the planets or something?
Well, there is a group intending on colonizing Mars for this
connecting port water.
Yeah.
It takes too much energy.
Well, right, and there will be a big bill to pay, and you know who will pay that bill when 50 people leave for Mars.
Yeah. When I read that Mars has 1% oxygen, we have 21% or something. There just isn't enough oxygen up here.
It seems like we ought to fix this place. It'd be a lot easier.
I was thinking when you said, as an implication, that sooner or later there will not be enough, or now there is not enough.
Right.
I was thinking also that refers to time, because we sort of have this mindset that says when we recognize the problem, there will be time to fix it, to find the solution.
Yes.
And that I see this also as saying that sooner or later there isn't going to be enough time after we discover a problem to develop the solution for it.
And we were fortunate with the
PCBs, the refrigerants, fluorine compounds. Because it was just a technical problem, the scientists and manufacturers, scientists would say, hey, this is really going to be bad in the future. And chemists would say, well, we have an alternative. And it was sort of a debate that took place out of the public domain. But those CFCs and those fluorine compounds are not yet to the place where they're still wafting their way to the upper atmosphere where they're going to do damage. Their damage will occur some 30, 50 years from now.
How much freon is used to do the cooling when they send somebody out in space?
Well,
I wasn't aware that they use freon for that, but I've heard recently.
Yeah, I think lots of environmental restrictions do not apply to our space program.
Our space military.
Space military.
Forest Service packed out would be.
The Kyoto Protocol that's languishing in the U.S. Senate does exempt all military activity from any CO2 emission curves, greenhouse gas emission curves. So I'm sure it's similar to the space military.
Well, anybody else? Let's be hopeful for a minute.
Well, you know, I think the planet will survive. Life will continue. We just may not make it very long. Although, I don't know. I mean, we keep pumping less CO2 in the atmosphere, and pretty soon we could look like, what is it? Which one is it? Venus, that's like all CO2?
Mm-hmm. Temperature of 7.
You think of Mars. Mars's atmosphere is what percent CO2? It's very high. Maybe we'll be Mars. Maybe we used to be Mars.
That's an interesting idea. The planets just sort of float out and as the...
Maybe we should establish the policy that China has. One couple, one child.
Now that's an interesting policy, and we need to talk about that in the next couple of times, because that's highly contested. And it's,
well, if you want to talk about a trend, global fertility has declined from over 6 children per woman in 1950 to 3.3 children per woman in the world today. So,
but it's still a number bigger than.
Yeah, and
bigger than two. Two is replacement rate fertility.
But if it's bigger than one, it'll double sometime.
Now you're talking about the gross birth rate, but what you really have to look at is the gross birth rate minus the gross death rate.
No, that's what I'm talking about. The total fertility rate is growth birth minus growth death.
Okay.
But we also have that problem of we are growing older. So there are many more people, older people, than there used to be.
That's not the problem.
Not in the United States, though.
Just demographic momentum.
Well, in Japan, too. Japan's getting very old. But you're right. There are enormous factors here that we're looking at. One of the things we're talking mainly now about policies. You know, well, the policy of China to lower the birth, to have a negative birth rate. There's no agency that can enforce that on the world at the moment. And it's one of the most sacred sort of rights that we acknowledge, and that's you can have kids, as many and when you want, and that's almost an inviolable right worldwide. Yes?
Well, I haven't heard anybody talk about the birth rate of the animal population.
Say something.
And how much, I don't know the numbers, how much has the domestic animal population increased along with human population?
It's growing faster than the human population.
And then if we were to deal with that, which is not as much of you can still choose if you want one child or three children, but maybe we don't need how many cows, I'm not sure a farmer's daughter, but how many cows, how many pigs, how many chickens do we need?
Or dogs and cats, who eat a tremendous amount of grain.
And how many places are we going to confine those and not dispose of their sewage correctly? Mm-hmm. We haven't talked about that part either, and that is something that would be less sensitive that we could maybe go into
maybe more loans are going
this person who was a blacksmith and says, but you can't take away my blacksmithing job, how will it be in the family? And along came Henry Ford, and the car mechanics did a lot better than the blacksmiths. Yeah. It was a healthier occupation, if you will, but not the greatest. But, you know, there was still a step up. And
sure.
So I would like to think there's a step up than having to have that many animals.
Maybe we should become vegetarians. Everybody should.
Okay, well, the options ahead of us are endless, and they aren't completely without hope. Human beings have proved themselves resilient in the past, and we really believe that God has in us some capacity for dominion. Maybe it could happen that we could do some things that make our life sustainable. I tend to think of it in terms of personal stuff and policy stuff, you know, public life, private life. And I don't think we can decide one without the other. And I think people tend to underestimate the importance of example. One of the reasons the whole world wants to live like Americans is because we've shown them movies, and we've sold them a culture and all its attendant goods, and we've been a bad example, right? That's as simple as
conspicuous consumption.
Conspicuous consumption. We glory in it.
But that's our opinion that we're a bad example. Their opinion is we're a good example.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and that makes the case even more powerfully. What if this nation, what if there were a sizable proportion of people who demonstrated a way to live a quality of life that was accessible to everyone? Because what we're doing now is not accessible. It'll fall apart before a fourth of the world gets halfway to our standard of living. What if there was a way that there was a visible population that had a quality of life that was accessible to everyone? And that's our subject for tomorrow. Talk about what would a personal life look like? What kind of a high quality of life that's accessible to everyone look like? What would we have to give up? What would we want to keep? And I'm gonna rely on you tomorrow, or this is on Wednesday, to help with that, because I wanna have some parameters. I kinda know what I want personally, but this is a way of getting ready for the next day when we talk about public life. And I think Christianity has always had its best success when it's been exemplary.